Welcome to Studio Tulsa on Health. I'm John Schumann, sitting in for Rich Fisher. If you decided to outsource the job of running a prison for cost savings, what other criteria would you use? How much less expensive would it need to be to make it quote-unquote cost-effective? It turns out the U.S. is engaged in just such an experiment. Unbeknownst to most of us, the Federal Bureau of Prisons has outsourced the warehousing of undocumented Central American immigrants to private contractors. The problem, as you might expect, is that in order to achieve cost savings, the contractors cut financial corners on elements like healthcare. In a scathing expose, freelance reporter Seth Fried Wessler has documented the human expense of these cost savings by reviewing more than 9,000 pages of medical records that he obtained under a Freedom of Information request from these contract prisons. Wessler, working with the investigative fund at the Nation Institute with additional support from the Puffin Foundation, was able to document more than 100 deaths in 11 contract prisons in just the last few years, when the numbers of immigrants prosecuted for illegal entry or re-entry into the country has skyrocketed due to increased federal enforcement. What has emerged is a two-tiered prison system in which convicted immigrant men in contract prisons are essentially denied health care and subject to early and wrongful death, compared with prisoners in Bureau of Prisons-run facilities. The Inspector General of the Department of Justice has acknowledged the inadequacies of the contract facilities, but there seems to be little will to change the status quo. These are undocumented immigrants, after all, a nearly voiceless group of people. Wessler's story appears on the cover of the February 15th issue of The Nation. In addition, his story is featured on a recent episode of the public radio program Reveal from the Center for Investigative Reporting. Reporter Seth Fried Wessler is our guest today on Studio Tulsa on Health. Seth Wessler, welcome to Studio Tulsa on Health. I want to start just by asking you, this article is very revealing and very detailed. The Bureau of Prisons, which is a federal agency, is outsourcing immigrant detention centers. So this is something that's very specific. It's only for immigrants. Where is this happening and why?
There are 11 federal prisons that actually are different from detention centers. So what I'm writing about here are criminal prisons, prisons for people who have been convicted of federal crimes, but who happen to be non-citizens. So the federal government has segregated out a group of prisons for people who don't have U.S. citizenship. And there are 11 of these prisons. They're very big prisons. About 23,000 people are held in the facilities. And unlike nearly all of the rest of the federal criminal justice system, these prisons have been privatized and are run by correctional companies, companies like the GEO Group or Corrections Corporation of America or Management and Training Corporation. And they operate under different and somewhat less stringent rules than the rest of the Federal Bureau of Prisons system. And these prisons actually started in the late 90s, largely in an attempt to save money and to find a way to expand prisons because the prison population was growing without expanding, increasing the number of federal workers in the workforce. And so the Clinton administration moved forward with this proposal. Now, there are 11 of these facilities used only for non-citizens, and they're really a major part of the federal criminal justice system. So, you know, you can land if two people convicted of the same crime, one person's a citizen and one is not, they're likely to be sent to different prisons solely on the basis of their citizenship status. And then there are other people in these prisons, 40% of the people in these prisons, actually, who are convicted of the criminal offense of crossing back over the border after deportation and sometimes locked up for months or years for what's called illegal reentry. The 11 prisons are scattered around the country. The largest group, four of them now, are in Texas and two in Georgia, one in California, and a number elsewhere, including one that's recently opened, the newest, that's in Oklahoma.
Where is that in Oklahoma?
It's in Hinton, Oklahoma, and it's opened just this past year. It's actually the one facility that's open that opened so recently that I didn't report on it. It's the newest of the group.
And you mentioned this 40% of those incarcerated are only there because of illegal reentry. That's the only crime they've committed?
So they are there on either illegal entry or an illegal re-entry crime. That's right. That is the crime that landed them in federal prison. And for the last decade, certainly, and sometime before that as well, the numbers of people being prosecuted criminally for this thing called illegal re-entry have skyrocketed. So actually in the early 90s, fewer than 4,000 people were prosecuted criminally. That is, we treated it as a crime to cross the border. In 2013, under the Obama administration, that number had increased to 91,000. It's now the most prosecuted federal crime. Border crossing crimes are more people are prosecuted for those crimes than for drug crimes in the federal courts. And those prosecutions that we really don't talk about very often have helped to fill the federal prison system, clog the federal courts, and help to drive the expansion, in this case, of a whole sort of subset of federal prisons that, in my reporting, I find are functioning, as I said, under different rules, often less stringent rules. And when it comes to medical care, the men inside, and they're all men, women who are non-citizens are mainstreamed into regular federal prisons, but the men inside are facing kinds of medical mistreatment that in some cases has led to the deaths of prisoners. If they had received kind of proper medical care, they very likely would have survived. There are real questions about cost cutting, about oversight, and about what rules these prisons have to follow, these sort of separate prisons for non-citizens.
Okay, well, and we'll get into that because you tell several very troubling stories about healthcare in these prisons. But I just wanted to clarify one other thing, which so you mentioned that it's only men, that women who are accused of illegal entry or reentry or both being illegal in terms of their immigration status and criminals are just mainstreamed into the regular federal prison system?
That's right. And in fact, there are many men who are non-citizens or who might be convicted of reentry who also find themselves in the regular Federal Bureau of Prisons facilities. But these prisons have a critical mass of those sorts of people with those sorts of convictions. And but yes, there aren't I think there just simply aren't enough women in the federal system to justify the creation of separate non-citizen prisons for women.
And looking at, say, the whole Federal Bureau of Prisons, not just for immigrants, how much is outsourced? Because we tend to, I mean, I've read about supermax prisons that are run by private contractors. I mean, so is this exclusively an immigrant issue?
Right. In the federal criminal justice system. So remember, prisons and jails run by counties, run by states, and run by the federal government. The federal prison system itself holds about 200,000 people. And just about 15% of those people are held in contract prisons. The vast majority of those prisons, all but one actually, are used to hold non-citizens. The logic is the federal government has sort of articulated why it holds non-citizens in these prisons. And it said as recently as 2014, the Bureau of Prisons has explained that non-citizens are a sort of ideal group of people to hold in these facilities that offer somewhat fewer services that regular prisons might provide people that they need in order to return to their communities, reentry services, rehabilitative programs. The BOP has said that because these people will later, after they serve their time, be transferred to immigration authorities and deported, because that's what happens when people are charged with crimes who aren't citizens in the United States. Because they'll be deported, there's not the same obligation to provide those sorts of services. And so the BOP has said these are sort of somewhat stripped down facilities. The other major difference here is that initially, the whole idea of prison contracting in the federal system was to save money. And while it's a real question whether the prisons have, in fact, saved money, there's research that shows that when you sort of add in the cost of oversight, of BOP's oversight, watching the operation of these prisons, making sure that they're complying with the rules that they have to comply with, the prisons actually cost as much as BOP-run prisons do. But in an attempt to save money, BOP staff people I interviewed, people who worked, officials who worked in the BOP's oversight offices, explained to me that quite basically, the more rules that are enforced, the more requirements that the federal government imposes on the companies that run these prisons, the more the companies are going to want to charge the federal government to run the facilities. And so the fewer rules, the more inexpensively the companies are likely to be able to run the prisons. And then they're expected to sort of come up with adequate systems to operate these facilities on their own. What I found in my reporting is that often they're cutting corners and people aren't treated as they should be, as they might be in regular federal prisons. And in the context of medical care, again, aren't receiving even baseline levels of care.
Yeah. And so it's worth, I think, highlighting this main irony from your reporting, which is that one of the main reason that's cited for outsourcing these prisons is to save money. And yet the analyses that you've looked at, I guess, don't show in fact, any great savings, I guess, other than arguably not expanding the federal workforce.
That's right. I mean, after the first contract facility opened in the Bureau of Prisons system, Congress ordered the BOP to do some research on whether there were, in fact, savings. And in 2005, a report was released on the first contract facility, which actually wasn't at that time when it began an immigrant-only facility. It is now. But that research found there were two reports. The first report generally found that the prison had saved on costs, but really only by cutting worker benefits. So that was where they kind of made up the difference. But a second report that the BOP contracted for itself, conducted by an economist, found that actually when you add in those sort of costs of oversight, that the prisons cost the same amount of money. What documents I've obtained show is that the BOP knows that, that the cost of oversight, the cost of monitoring is driving up costs. But at this point, these prisons are a central part of the Bureau of Prisons system. And so the BOP has moved forward with, there's a lot of momentum now, even as the evidence may not support the continuation of this contracting experiment. The BOP has moved forward because the BOP now has 23,000 beds that it's contracted out, and that's a major part of its operation.
You're listening to Studio Tulsa on Health. I'm John Schumann, sitting in today for Rich Fisher. My guest is Seth Fried Wessler, who's a reporter with the Investigative Fund of the Nation Institute. He has an article titled, "This Man Will Almost Certainly Die," the cover story of the February 15th issue of The Nation. And Seth, this was a major undertaking, this investigative report. You mentioned 11 prisons. You looked at some 9,000 pages of medical records that you had gotten Freedom of Information requests to obtain?
That's right. So a number of years ago, I heard from the relative of a man who died in one of these prisons, and who told me that she believed that her brother had been neglected, medically neglected, that he would have survived if he had received proper medical care. And, you know, I couldn't find anything. I couldn't dig into that claim. I couldn't prove it one way or another. But I was interested in figuring out what was happening inside these prisons, because I'd heard for years complaints from advocates and from prisoners about what was happening inside this class of federal contract prisons. So I issued this FOIA request, this Freedom of Information Act request, asking for all of the medical records of people who've died inside. And last year, I started to receive these files. I filed a lawsuit, actually, in federal court in order to obtain the files. And they started to arrive. And I realized that what I was receiving really were the stories of the final weeks and months in the lives of what ended up being 103 men, 103 files that I obtained. There are others who have died, but those are the files that I obtained. And so I actually started asking medical doctors to help me to review these files, to think about and help me understand what was happening inside of them. Was this medical care adequate? Was the medical care following baseline standards of care that one would expect anywhere? And each file was reviewed by at least two medical doctors, or in the case of suicides, and there were seven of those that I looked into, also reviewed by psychiatrists. And in a third of the cases where doctors felt that there was enough information for them to render a judgment on the adequacy of the care that the men had received, in a third of the cases, the doctors who read the files said that not only had the care been clearly inadequate, that there were clear signs of inadequacy in the medical care, but that those inadequacies had likely contributed to premature deaths of men held in these facilities, that had they been provided better care, had they been seen by doctors, they likely would have survived. And so in my reporting for The Nation and for Reveal, I tell the stories of some of these men, men like, for example, Claudio Fajardo Saucedo, who's a man who was held in a facility called Reeves in West Texas. And when he arrived there, he tested positive for latent tuberculosis. And that's not terribly uncommon in incarcerated populations.
This is the thing where they put a little wheel on your forearm, and if it reacts, you've been exposed to tuberculosis.
That's right. And so in the Bureau of Prisons, and in many contexts, a positive TB test should spur an offer of an HIV test. The two diseases together, and you can talk about this, I'm sure, can be particularly aggressive if they operate together. And so people who test positive for TB ought to be, and the BOP's rules say this, tested for HIV as well. Well, this man wasn't tested for HIV. And then over the next 2 years, in fact, soon after he arrived and then for 2 years, he complained of increasing pain, back pain, tooth pain, and significantly headaches that became worse and worse. He became more and more sick. And over a 2-year period, he served on a sentence for illegal reentry. Fajardo Saucedo never saw a doctor, never saw a medical doctor. He visited the medical clinic, and nearly every time he would see a member of the nursing staff. In fact, almost always he saw what are called somebody who's called a licensed vocational or licensed practical nurse. They usually have about a year of training and are generally trained to be sort of in a supportive role, supporting nurses or MDs or doctors, not to provide, you know, substantive routine care. Well, that's who saw him nearly every time he went to the clinic. And nearly every time he went to the clinic, he was sent back to his bunk with ibuprofen or Tylenol, even as his condition worsened and worsened, until one day after visiting the clinic, he was so sick that he fell down, scraped his face, and was sent back to the clinic, where the doctor, who wasn't there but was called, instructed the clinic to send him to the local emergency room. He was diagnosed and tested positive for HIV and died just days later, actually, of a AIDS-related brain infection. The BOP, after his death, looked into what had happened and found that had he received care at all from a doctor, had he been tested for HIV, and had this prison followed those rules, that he very likely could have been treated and might well be alive. And these are stories of people who really suffer quite intensely, and they're repeated over and over again in these medical records. The medical records, in some ways, open a door into a prison system that is generally closed, that has been until now very, very difficult to see into, very, very hard to know what's happening inside. These create a real window into what it's like.
It's a really upsetting story to hear about. And you have other examples where patients, essentially the same sort of thing happened, where they had a physical complaint, or in many cases a mental complaint, where it simply just wasn't addressed or wasn't adequately addressed until it was far too late. Like, there's the story you had in here of Martin Acosta, who it took until he was, you know, vomiting and excreting blood for him to get actual treatment in a hospital, but he'd been complaining of stomach aches the whole time, and I guess eventually was found to have advanced stomach cancer.
That's right, and he, you know, very quickly at the hospital, once he was finally sent there, a massive tumor was found, and he died not long afterwards of stomach cancer. That, again, doctors who reviewed the files, including a former Bureau of Prisons doctor who read the file for me, felt that very likely could have been treated, and that the low-level medical workers who saw him missed the signs of illness. Another man, Jesus Enrique Zavala Montes, died. He committed suicide in a California prison, and he was, soon after he arrived at the prison, showing signs really immediately that he was suffering significantly with mental illness, with delusions. He broke a window and told somebody that he had heard voices that told him to do so. In an early intake form, he actually wrote that he had attempted to commit suicide in the past and that he had been prescribed previously in Mexico psychiatric drugs. Well, in this prison, he received almost no mental health care at all and was found hanging in his solitary cell less than a month after his arrival. And those sorts of stories repeat in other suicides. One Bureau of Prisons official I talked to said, you know, in regular BOP prisons, mental health care is available. And we certainly know that mental health care isn't always what it should be in those facilities. But he said in these contract prisons for immigrants, it's much harder to find mental health care. He said, we just hold them there, essentially waiting for them to be then later transferred to immigration authorities and deported.
You're listening to Studio Tulsa on Health. I'm John Schumann, sitting in today for Rich Fisher. My guest is Seth Fried Wessler, who is a reporter with the Investigative Fund of the Nation Institute, and he has the cover story entitled This Man Will Almost Certainly Die on the February 15th issue of The Nation. It's an expose, an investigative report on an alarming trend of outsourced prison management from the Federal Bureau of Prisons, who has contracted with a number of different for-profit companies particularly for immigrant prisons. These are illegal immigrants who are here oftentimes with crimes no more serious than illegal entry or reentry, but oftentimes do have other crimes, it should be said, drug offenses and other things. And really the deplorable, now you mentioned a number, 103 cases that you reviewed. Were those all deaths, 103 deaths?
103 deaths since 1998, when the first of these contract prisons opened. There are more deaths that happened in these prisons, but those are the ones that I obtained through the open records request. And then each of those files was reviewed by medical doctors who helped me to understand what was happening inside these files. And they really do tell stories of the last months or weeks of these men's lives. And they're stories that, you know, generally don't make it into the public. And even many of the families of these men had not heard. So, you know, when people are locked up in prison, they're separated from their communities and they're cut off in many ways. These men in these prisons are often doubly cut off because very often their relatives are not only separated by the prison walls, but also by a border. Most of these men are Mexican nationals. Many of their families live in Mexico. And so I called people or visited families of people of some of these men who died, and they knew nearly nothing about what had happened to their loved ones. In one case, the sister and mother of a man, they knew that he had died in a prison, but they didn't know why he was there. So when I told them that he had been locked up only for illegal reentry on a 4-month illegal reentry prosecution sentence, they told me that they were shocked. They figured to be in federal prison in the United States, you must have done something horrible. And I think, you know, there's so little information. So, you know, these men in the past, they've died without mention at all. In fact, the only attention that medical neglect in these particular prisons ever receives happens after prisoners protest. In Texas last year, one of these prisons in Willacy County, Texas, in South Texas, actually closed down after prisoners there protested over what they described as terrible medical conditions. That protest turned into a riot, and the prison was left so destroyed, holes in the sides of the Kevlar tents where they're held, fires set to the buildings, that the government declared it uninhabitable and ended the contract with the company, moving all the prisoners out. But other than those sorts of events, those sorts of high-profile protests, these stories very rarely make it into public view.
Seth, I wanted to also point out, you in the piece, you it seems like got to interview Michael Horowitz, who is the Inspector General for the Department of Justice, who was called in to evaluate these contract prisons. And the Department of Justice's own audit of one of the prisons called Reeves was that it was significantly understaffed for at least 34 out of 37 months under the contract. And so I guess if the Inspector General is aware of the problem, is there anything that's changed or what can change?
Well, after that inspection and after the audit was performed, the particular prison, Reeves, actually where Claudio Fajardo Saucedo was held, the man I described who died of an AIDS-related brain infection, the prison did begin to staff the medical clinic more adequately for a time. And Michael Horowitz was clear that he doesn't know necessarily if they've continued to do that, but certainly for a time, the prison was better staffed. But I also obtained monitoring reports from that facility, monitoring reports of medical care that the BOP itself performed to check up on the prison's functioning. And for years, in 2009, 2010, 2011, the prison was consistently failing to perform adequately in certain areas of its medical operation. And the BOP was consistently finding the same failings, the same deficiencies, and yet the prison remained open. And then, in a monitoring report that I obtained from as recently as last year, the very same deficiency that patients who had tested positive for tuberculosis were not properly followed up on, were not properly treated, the BOP found once again in 2015 that same deficiency had occurred, that same problem was still operating. And so there are questions about what's changing, about what kind of power the federal government is exerting to ensure that those problems are fixed. And at some point, questions about why it is that prisons that continue to fail to operate as they should and as they're required to are allowed to continue running. These are contract facilities. These aren't BOP facilities. And those questions are beginning to be asked by advocates and others in D.C.
Seth, your reporting has a strong public interest flavor to it. And I should point out you've been featured. This particular article that is the cover story of The Nation magazine is also featured on a recent episode of the NPR show Reveal, which is both a show and a podcast. And you can listen to that episode or stream it at revealnews.org. Reveal is a program of the Center for Investigative Reporting. But you also, a couple of years ago, were on an episode of This American Life, another favorite NPR show, where you reported about hundreds of thousands of people who were actually leaving the U.S. to go back to Central America. And by virtue of their American-inflected accents, are now doing things like working in call centers. Is that accurate?
That's right. Yeah, I mean, I've been reporting on immigration and immigration enforcement and the consequences of immigration enforcement for years, looking at what happens to people who are detained, the families of people who are deported, and to what life is like after people are forcibly sent back to the countries of their birth through deportation. And I found in the course of my reporting this story of young people who'd grown up in the United States but who were undocumented here. People who, you know, maybe came here with their parents when they were 2 years old and who spoke fluent English and who in many ways considered the United States to be their home, but because they didn't have papers, were deported. And many of these people have landed in jobs in Mexico, working at call centers for U.S. companies, speaking English on the phone with American customers, often sort of pretending to be in the United States. You know, people who, for all intents and purposes, could have found these jobs, these same call center jobs in the U.S., speaking English in the U.S., had they still been here and had those jobs been here. But, you know, the companies have decided to outsource the jobs. And these folks who have been deported are kind of ideal candidates. They're American, but for the fact that they didn't have papers. And so for a caller from the United States, it's as if they're talking to somebody next door.
How did you become an investigative reporter?
You know, I've been reporting for some time. I worked as a researcher, and that research often took the form of articles. And then those articles that were sometimes quicker and sometimes news pieces would suggest longer-term stories, and I began digging. And so my reporting work that was often faster and about on a beat, often about immigration, turned into these longer-term investigative projects. And often the projects suggest the next project. So my reporting on immigration and deportation, people would talk to me about wanting to come back, and often people who were deported would come back. And that put them at risk of ending up in federal prison on illegal reentry charges. And it tipped me off to the existence of these prisons. And then I began looking into what was happening inside. You know, the world is filled with stories and connections, and it's not hard to find areas that are sort of shadowy and need investigating.
Seth Reed Wessler is a reporter for the Investigative Fund of the Nation Institute. His cover story in this week's Nation magazine is called This Man Will Almost Certainly Die. Seth Wessler, thank you so much for being here.
Thank you very much.
Well, that's our show for today. Studio Tulsa on Health is produced and edited by Scott Gregory. I'm John Schumann, sitting in for Rich Fisher. Thanks for listening.